Ezra chapter 7, and here we go. Finally get to meet this person who's been waiting in the wings all along. Why was he waiting in the wings is one of the questions we have to discuss. So I didn't give you the outline of the chapter on the sheet because there were too many sources that I wanted to bring about Ezra himself. But basically, the opening six verses of chapter 7 are, let's meet Ezra. Then we get the timing of his arrival, when he came. Then we get Artaxasta's decree empowering Ezra, followed by Ezra's tefillah, his prayer when he arrives. Yes? So the book of Ezra is credited to Ezra. It's Ezra himself. Okay. So, of course, when we say, now Ezra arrived, we have to note something which we've already discussed a little bit, that Ezra may already be here. Right? He might have been Zerubbabel, he might have been Shesh Batzar, as we've already discussed, and there were two reasons for saying that. The simple reason is because it's hard to think that he wouldn't have figured in the initial Aliyah. How could somebody of this status, and we're going to see what he's like, how could he not have been in that first group? And then the second reason, because we saw this when we read chapter 3 of Ezra, it would make Nehemiah chapter 7 fit really well with Ezra chapter 3 if they had actually been here from the beginning. That was the whole business where we saw the timing, the suspicious timing in chapter 3, with dealing with the building of the temple, seems to match the timing dates that are offered in Nehemiah 7 for building the wall of the city. So that's why some suggest that he was actually here before. There is also a view that Ezra arrives after Nehemiah. However, Encyclopedia Mikra'it rejects it, and I think rightly so, as unsubstantiated. There are some interesting ideas that are proposed to suggest that, in fact, Ezra came in after Nehemiah, but it doesn't fit the chronology of our book, and I think it doesn't fit the logic of the story.
Would it just be a literary device?
That what?
Would you respect bringing Ezra in here? I mean, we all read books where da-da-da-da-da, and you get to page 400 when finally reveals itself.
Right. The problem that you have with it is then it is that I'm not sure which way you're reading it, but if you're reading it as literary device and Ezra really was here all along.
Ezra wrote this.
Yeah.
He's here all along. He's leading up to bring him into the dramatic place.
The problem is that he left himself out of what has to be the most important thing to happen to the Jews in a very long time. Why write yourself out of that picture?
Could be maybe like to explain what's going on, to give Luna. Like if we're going with literary devices, you read the first Harry Potter book, Harry Potter does not actually show up until chapter 2. Like there's a huge chunk of text that's just explaining the situation. You think, oh, well, Harry Potter defeated Lord Voldemort, but it's like you don't hear about it till later because they need to set up. So maybe that's what Ezra's doing. Before you can hear about what he did, he wants to know what was going on.
Right, but the difference would be with my respect for J.K. Rowling notwithstanding. Realistically, what you're describing would be more parallel to leaving Harry Potter out until book 3. In all seriousness, because that's really what you would be doing. Because you built the Beis Hamikdash without him. Like, why bother showing up at this point?
Was he born at that point? How old is he right now?
No. The argument that Debbie was giving is that he was here and we're just writing him in now. But if he was there, how do you omit him from this very, very... You know what it's like? I'll tell you what it's like, and then I'll go to Sharon. But or Shayna, it was a hand over there. What it's more like is the beginning of Parshas Yisro, right? Parshat Yitro. The beginning of that Parsha has Yisro show up among the Jewish people, with in tow Moshe's wife Tzipora and their two sons. And there's a classic debate as to when that happened, right? If you read it chronologically, all is fine. Moshe had left his family in Midian, because why bring them to Egypt when you have all this turmoil going on and the Jews are suffering? He leaves them in Egypt, and now Yisro then reunites them with Moshe after they get out of Egypt. However, if you read the story the way Rashi does, and there's a lot of logic behind Rashi's way of reading the story, it's written in that spot in order to contrast Yisro with Amalek. However, the story didn't happen until later, after the Torah was given. Right? The story happens after the Torah was given. There's a lot of logic to that. For example, what is Moshe spending all his time judging the people with if they don't have a Torah yet? Right? That's what happens in that story, among other reasons why that story should really be later. But the point is that if you read the story that way, that means that Moshe's family missed the giving of the Torah at Sinai. I mean, that's a startling thing when you first think about that.
They were all there because
all souls were there, but even the souls of people who were alive at that time. That's hard. The point is, and the reason why I mentioned this, is because that's the equivalent of what you've just done. You have the seminal moment in Jewish history. We're building the second temple. It's only going to happen three times in Jewish history, right? The first, second, and third. That's all you get. And Ezra was there, but we're not going to include him in the story? That's difficult. If you're going to say that the answer is that he only showed up now, then you're agreeing with the chronology of the book, and I have no problem with that. My problem is if you believe that he was there all along, why didn't you... I mean, calling him Zerubbabel, it's very, very strange to me. Shana, and then Karen.
So... If we're looking at Ezra as the author, then he's the one who's shaping this, quote, origin myth for the building of the second temple. So it may be that he's presenting it in a way that Israel is more self-reliant, more self-motivated, and that's why he's effacing himself. Pay no attention to the man.
But there are leaders. He puts in Zerubbabel. He puts in Yoshua ben Yotzadak. He's not painting them as a self-actualizing nation. He's saying that there were leaders. It just wasn't me. So I don't buy it. I believe the book is written as a historical work. And he is saying, no, this is when I came. I got here after they built the building. That's the way it goes sometimes. Karen and then Susan.
So is that what you think?
Yeah, that's what I think. I think he showed up now. I mean, we're going to talk about it more in a few minutes if we get there. But I think, yeah, I think he showed up now. Susan, you'll see.
We learned earlier that there was an interpretation that he's taken out to make sure everything he has. So, if that interpretation is taken, we got there.
Right, so I'm not sure of what you're... we do have the idea that he stayed back intentionally. And we do have the idea that he is behind the division of those Jews who returned to the land into the different lineages, right? That we saw from the Talmud and Kiddushin. Not that he's there in order to make sure everybody goes, because if so, he was a failure. But he did stay back with a purpose, which we're gonna talk about. David, and then we're going to go further.
I have one question and one concept. The question is, where is the source that he's Zerubbabel? And my other thing is, didn't we understand that he is the direct link to Yirmiyahu?
So that's where we're going with this question of why he stayed. In terms of the question of where he is named as being one of these other figures, we're going to see some of the Gemara on that here. So let's talk about what in the world Ezra was doing while the Jews were building the temple. What was this all about? So first of all, when is this? Is a key question. You ask the question of how old was he at this time. So when does this happen? So the king we're naming in the story is Artaxasta, which may be a title for Persian kings, or may be a person by the name, the unfortunate name perhaps, of Artaxasta. Can you imagine if he had been a Torchiner? Artaxasta Torchiner? That would be great. We missed our chance with our kids. If you don't like to spell Artaxasta, you can just call me Artaxerxes. Okay. So, assuming the king here is Artaxerxes I. So he was king, according to the historical count, from 465 before the Common Era to 424 before the Common Era. Ezra is going to arrive in year 7 of Artaxasta, and so that would make this roughly 458 before the Common Era, which means... it is about 80 years after the Jews originally came back under Cyrus. Which means that he may well not have been alive at the time of the original decree of Cyrus. We know that by the time he shows up, he's established as a leader. We're going to get that very clearly. This is 80 years after Cyrus's permission. However, there is another view in the Gemara in Erchin, in source number 3. The Gemara here seems to think that Ezra arrives right after the temple is completed. Right? Our first view gives us a gap of about 50-something years between the completion of the temple and when Ezra shows up. However, here in source number 3, you get the Gemara statement. Rav Ashi Omar, Hanoch Shis Shani, he's making calculations about the laws of Shemitah and account for when the Shemitah year is, the sabbatical year. So Rav Ashi is dealing with problems with certain years and trying to make the numbers work. And he says, Hanoch Shis Shani ad Desalik Ezra Umaktish Lokachashiv Lehu. The 6 years, meaning from the construction of the temple until Ezra arrived and sanctified the land, are not included in the calculation of the Shemitah years. What's he talking about? Dichsiv, because the text says, Beidayin betela savidas beis alakana di Birushalayim, that our work on the temple was halted for a period of time. It's halted until the 2nd year of King Darius. This house was completed the 3rd day of Adar, which is in the 6th year of King Darius. So he says, you have this period of time where nothing's happening, 2nd year of Darius until the 6th year, and we know about this already. Until the 2nd year of Darius, nothing is happening. Then they're building and they complete it in the 6th year of Darius. And then we learn, Ba'oso Zman L'Shana Haba, same time, a year later, Allah Ezra V'galuso Imo, Ezra and his exiles came back. Dechsiv V'yavo Yerushalayim V'chodesh HaMishi, as we're going to see in chapter 7, they arrive in Jerusalem in the 5th year, in the 5th month. He Ashana Shviz Lamelach, the king's 7th year. So the reason why I mention this is not to go into the Shemitah calculation and the 6 years from the 2nd year of Darius until the 7th year of Darius. That's not my point. My point is to say that Rav Ashi believes that Ezra shows up in the 7th year of Artaxasta, which is the 7th year of Darius. That Darius and Artaxasta are the same person, consistent with the Gemara and Rosh Hashanah that we already discussed a while back. And the idea is then that Ezra arrives not 50-something years after the temple is built, but a year after the temple is built. You follow? So we have two different options for our chronology of when Ezra is there. And Rashi and Ibn Ezra both follow the Gemara's tack on this. Okay, so who is Ezra? Well, as we're going to see, the Gemara is going to say that Ezra is a student of a man by the name of Baruch ben Neriah. In the interests of time, I will be somewhat brief regarding Baruch ben Neriah and just tell you the text outside. I gave you references, though, in source number 4, so you could actually look it up. But Baruch ben Neriah is the scribe for Yirmiyahu. He is the sofer for Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu gets a well-known message from God in which he is told to go to his family in the city of Anatot and to buy land and to write up the deed and to put the deed in a jug and to keep it as a message to the Jews that they are going to come back to this land. It's a message that there is still hope. You're not being kicked out forever. The people of Anatot didn't like Yirmiyahu, but that's its own discussion. But Baruch ben Neriah is the scribe. In Yirmiyahu chapter 36, he writes down what becomes Eicha, to be read on fast days. In Yirmiyahu Mem Gimel, in Yirmiyahu chapter 43, there's a fellow by the name of Yochanan ben Kereach. We don't like him. Right? CF, the story of the murder of Gedalia. But Yochanan ben Kereach accuses Baruch of being a corrupting influence, instigating Yirmiyahu to give false prophecies. So Baruch ben Neriah is a sofer, he's a scribe, who becomes viewed as something more than just a scribe. He is viewed as a leader. And that's what we have in the text in Tanakh. What you will never find is the idea that, we will never find is a verse putting Ezra and Baruch in the same sentence. You will not find anywhere that says Baruch is a student of Ezra. I mean, Ezra is a student of Baruch, sorry, the other way around. You will never find that Ezra is listed anywhere as a student of Baruch. However, the association is logical in the sense that who do you have who could possibly train a scribe? Because Ezra is going to be introduced to us as a sofer Sofer Mahir, a very able scribe. We think the word Sofer means scribe. We have to come back to what the word Sofer means. But the association between the two is, well, who else could have taught Ezra? Who else is logical to teach Ezra? Well, Baruch is a scribe. He's around. He's a leading figure. It makes sense to think that he was the mentor of Ezra. And then, like everybody else, we don't know when Baruch dies. And so what we end up saying is that Ezra is a student of Baruch, and he remains in exile to learn from Baruch until Baruch dies. And at that point, Ezra makes the leap. Take a look at source number 5. Source number 5 is dealing with the calendar. The Talmud Yerushalmi talks about the problem we have with adding a second Adar. We talked about adding to the calendar last week when we dealt with the question of Chizkiah's Pesach that was observed in the second month. So normally the decision to add a month to the calendar is a decision made in Israel. That's what's supposed to happen. However, the Talmud here tells us it didn't always work that way. When they can't add in Israel, they add it outside of Israel. The court will convene wherever it needs to. Yirmiyahu was responsible to coordinate the calendar outside of Israel when he's in exile in Babylon. Yechezkel iber b'chutz la'aretz. So did the prophet Yechezkel. Baruch Ben-Neriah iber b'chutz la'aretz. Baruch Ben-Neriah did it too. And then we get one of the sages, Hananiah, the nephew of Rabbi Yoshua, also did it outside of Israel. And then they go into a discussion of how could he do it? Wasn't there a certain sage around in Israel who could have done it, and so on. But look at the company that Baruch Ben-Neriah is in. Yechezkel, Yirmiyah, and Baruch Ben-Neriah. That's the way that he is viewed. Which brings us to source number 6, the key Gemara in Megillah. Actually, sorry, this is not the key Gemara. This is also a key Gemara, but it's not the one I wanted to get to yet. It's a step along the way. Source number 6, Amar of Nachman. Rav Nachman says, Malachi ze Mordechai. Malachi, as in the last of the Nevi'im, is Mordechai. Malachi, we know, is a prophet in the second generation of the second Beis HaMikdash. Well, he had a life before he became Malachi. Malachi wasn't actually his name. Malachi just means an agent of God. My agent is the way to read it according to this. Why was he called Malachi? Because he was second in command to the king, because he was Mordechai. Not God's agent, but the king's agent. Meisvei. To which the Gemara challenges, and this is what I wanted to bring this for here. We're going to come back to this source later. But right now, the key line is this. We've learned, Baruch ben Neriah, v'Saraya ben Masya, v'Daniel u'Mordechai Bilshan v'Chagai Zechariah u'Malachi Kula Nisnavu v'Shnas Shtayim l'Dayavesh. The following people all prophesied in the second year of King Darius. Baruch ben Neriah is one. Saraya is another. By the way, Daniel's in there. For those who remember when we learned Daniel several years ago, and we had a debate, is Daniel a Navi or not? Right? Abarbanel says he's a Navi. Everybody else says, no, he's not. But this Gemara supports Abarbanel. It lists Daniel as having been a Navi at least once. But in any case, the key point here is this name, Saraya ben Maaziah. Assuming you take the view that this is the same Saraya who is the father of Ezra, which is debated, that puts Baruch together with Ezra's father. It's just one more link between them. We're going to come back to this Gemara. We're not done with this Gemara. But now flip the page. Or if you already flipped it, stay on where you are. Source number 7. Gadol Talmud Torah Yoser Mi Binyan Beis HaMikdash. Studying Torah is even greater than building the temple. As long as Baruch ben Neriah was alive, Ezra stayed with him. Ezra remained with him. And so you see the Medrash as well in source number 8. Medrash in Shir HaShirim Rabbah. Ezra b'siyato v'chabura solo alu ba'osasha. Ezra and his group did not ascend with the original group. V'lama lo ala ba'osa shah Ezra? Why didn't Ezra go? Shayad sarach levarer tamudo lifnei Baruch ben Neriah, because he still needed to clarify his learning in front of Baruch ben Neriah. V'yale Baruch ben Neriah. So why didn't Baruch ben Neriah go? Why did he stay? Ella Amri Baruch ben Neriah Adam Gadol v'yishish haya. Because Baruch ben Neriah was a great and aged man. Va'afilu begalactica lo hayachal itain. He couldn't even be carried on a galactica. I looked all over in Latin and Greek dictionaries to find out what this was. I assumed it was a litter of some kind. I could not find the reference. Yes?
It's probably a milk.
Why? Lacta galactos.
No,
lactose. Clever. Clever. I have no idea. This is as good as anything I got right now. Okay. Shane has a job. Yeah.
Look up Stein cells.
Oh, he's written the whole thing.
Right, but he wasn't there for Eric Olive, from all of the...
That's okay.
So, but doesn't he still, like, if somebody, he had to be related to...
Yeah, but we never get that. No. Shmuel is credited with writing the book of Shoftim. Shmuel never met any of the Shoftim. I mean, he was the last Shofate, so maybe he met whoever was right before him. But that's basically it. It doesn't, yeah, we don't credit our sources. It's a lot easier that way. The Gemara here and the Medrash here say that Ezra is undergoing a position of training under the scribe Baruch ben Neriah. Encyclopedia Mikrait records a suggestion as well that Ezra was the king's scribe for Jewish affairs, which is an interesting idea. It may explain a little bit why the king is going to call him an able scribe, because he was. So it's a possibility. But Ezra's roles for us go far beyond student of Baruch ben Neriah. Ezra means everything when you get to the chain of Jewish tradition, all building on what you see in this book, but the credit he gets goes beyond what we'll see in this book. So Ezra clearly is known as a scribe, and we're going to see it in chapter 7 of B'mehera B'yameinu. Ezra is absolutely a scribe, but look at what the Gemara does with it. Source number 10, I brought you one piece. I'm sorry, number 9. I brought you one piece of a long discussion in the Gemara about how we ended up with the alphabet that we use today in our Torah texts. Historically, the Hebrew that was found is what is often called today Paleo-Hebrew, which is to say the Hebrew of the dinosaurs. You can find resemblances between the alphabets, but it's a fundamentally different alphabet. How did we end up with the one that we use today? So the Gemara here in number 9 gives you a very interesting version of what happened. Originally, it was the Hebrew language, but the font, if you will, that we used was the ancient Hebrew alphabet. Chazra v'nitna lam b'mei Ezra. It was then given to them in Ezra's time, b'chsav ashurit, with the Assyrian font, v'lashon arami, and they spoke Aramaic. And then Biru Lan Yisroch Savashrit Velashana Kodesh. We decided to go with the Assyrian font and the sacred tongue, so we use Lashon HaKodesh. I'm not going into the whole discussion now about the evolution of the text that we use, the alphabet that we use. It's a great topic, but it's a series of shiurim. It's not like just something you drop in offhand. The point that I wanted to show you here is that Ezra is credited with this change. This idea here that we're going to switch the alphabet that we use for the Torah is one that is credited to Ezra. Not only that, the cleaning up of the Torah text is credited to Ezra as well. Take a look at source number 10, passage from the Jerusalem Talmud. Shlosha Sfarim Matzu Ba'azara. They found 3 scrolls in the temple. Sefer Me'oni, V'sefer Za'atuti, V'sefer He. They're given three different names based on characteristics of the text in those books. Be'echad, and in one of them, Matz'u Katuv, they found it, Rin Me'on Elokei Kedem, Parshas V'zos HaBracha, the very end of the Chumash, there's a sentence which you will recognize in the Hebrew as Me'ona Elokei Kedem. That's the Aliyah that we usually read for, that we always read, for Chasan Torah, right? When we complete the Sefer Torah, it starts Me'ona Elokei Kedem. They found a scroll that actually said Ma'on. But two others said, Me'ona Elokei Kedem. So what did they do? They voted. V'kimu shnayim u'bilu echad. They went with the two against the one and said, clearly the two are the one that is what was supposed to be correct. And that's how they cleaned up the text. They went through and looked for any divergences. And where there was a divergence, they went with the majority over the minority. That's the idea. What this does with the whole discussion about every letter of our Torah being what was given at Sinai, and how do you know that the two are really right and the one is wrong, also a fun discussion for another time. But the point that I'm bringing here is that Ezra is credited as the one to finalize our text. This comes from his identity as a sofer, as well as a public reader of the Torah. We are going to see Ezra have a public Torah reading and an enforcement of halacha. And that becomes part of Ezra's identity to us. Take a look at source number 11. The Gemara there is talking about times when we thought that Torah was over. And what happened? Bitchila, originally, kishnishtakha Torah mi Yisrael, when Torah was forgotten from Israel, Allah Ezra mi Bavel v'yisda, Ezra ascended from Babylon and he established it. Never mind, they built a Beis HaMikdash before he showed up. But he was the one who established Torah. Chaza v'nishtakha, eventually later on it was forgotten, and then Hillel is credited for coming to Israel and reestablishing it. And then there's more as the Gemara continues. Susan, and then, yeah. So there actually are those who credit Ezra with vocalization and trup. It's not so clear to me, but there are those who credit Ezra with that as well. Yes?
How did they know the Beit HaMikdash without the Torah? I mean, they need the instructions,
though. Right. So the phrase Nishtakha Torah, the phrase that Torah was forgotten, cannot be taken literally.
So what does it mean?
So what it would likely mean is what we're going to see in the book, which is to say, Ezra finds that they're not properly observant of the holidays and of Shabbos. He finds that the men have married out among non-Jewish women, things like that.
Okay, so he trusts their Beit HaMikdash. It's not like he comes in like, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong.
Or maybe he does, for all we know.
But nowhere in the text it says that Ezra came and got the wrecking balls and took down the Beit HaMikdash, and then they built Beit HaMikdash. Part two. Like, it doesn't say that.
We have to get there.
Weeks and weeks away.
Yeah, we have to get there and see what he does and what he doesn't do. But we also have to look at what the obvious text is and then what's the subtext and what's going on. Yeah?
During the time that the Jews are have returned.
Yeah.
And there's letters going back and forth to Persia.
Yeah.
Is Ezra in a position to be involved with those letters going back and forth as the scribe in Jewish affairs?
It's a good question. It's a good question. We have no reference to him being involved.
Where do we get that he is a scribe?
We still have to get there. I mean, if you want to jump to chapter 7...
No, I don't want to jump.
Okay. I know, because you can see there where he's called that. What you want to see specifically is sentence 12 in chapter 7, and that will give you your first reference by the king to Ezra as a scribe. You can see it there, and you can see it again in sentence 21. But one of the things that Ezra becomes known for is the public Torah reading. From that, we get the idea that Ezra has a key role to play in establishing our practice of public Torah reading. Take a look, please, at source number 12. Ezra Tikein La'en Li Yisrael Shu Karin Klalos Shabbataras Kohenim Kodem Atzeres Rishabah Mishnah Torah Kodem Rosh Hashanah. That Ezra enacts that we read the Tochacha, the warning in the Torah of punishment, that we read the one in Sefer Vayikra, meaning in Bechukosai, before Shavuos, and the one that's in Devarim, Parashas Kisavo, is read before Rosh Hashanah. My time, a why? Amar Abaye v'itema Reish Lakish k'dei shetik l'shana v'kil l'osea, so that the year ends with its curses, and then you could start something fresh afterwards. And we actually, as Tosfos notes, we insert a week in between the curse and the holiday, so you don't go straight from the curse into the holiday. However, this is consistent with what we're going to see Ezra do when he reads the Torah aloud, and it becomes a mechanism for rebuke of the nation for their wrongdoing. Whatever that wrongdoing is, we still have to get to. But then take a look at number 13. Number 13 speaks of Ezra's role in establishing the public Torah reading as well as various other practices. I didn't bring you the entire Gemara with all of Ezra's 10 enactments, but look at it. Asara Takanos Tikein Ezra. Ezra made 10 enactments. Shekorin B'mincha B'Shabbos, to have the Torah reading on Shabbos afternoon. The Koran B'Sheni V'Chamishi, to read on Monday and Thursday. The Dunin B'Sheni V'Chamishi, to have courts established on Mondays and Thursdays. U'mechabsin V'Chamishi B'Shabbos, you should do your laundry on Thursday so you have nice clothing for Shabbos. Dot, dot, dot. And then it goes on to say, Shukaran B'mincha B'Shabbos Mishum Yoshve Kronos. The reason for reading Shabbos afternoon is because of people who sit on the corner during the week and they have their stores open. It doesn't mean a corner sitter like someone who's idle. It means somebody who has a stall out on the street and he doesn't have time to go hear the Torah reading on Monday and Thursday. So therefore, Shabbos afternoon, at least he'll get a Torah reading in. And then they ask, but did Ezra really do the Monday and Thursday? Didn't Moshe do the Monday and Thursday? There's a whole medrash associating that with Moshe. When the Jews traveled, they didn't have water in the very beginning of our travels through the wilderness. And the Gemara's answer is that you're right, and there was an evolution of enactments, but Ezra is part of that chain of enactments. The Malbim actually has a very dramatic comment on this. Malbim is very sharp. Remember, this is the period of time of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, the Great Assembly, right? The Great Assembly that's credited with so many different things. That's this group. Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi are supposed to be in that group. Ezra is supposed to be in that group. Mordechai is supposed to be in that group. This Great Assembly. So, if you remember your Pirkei Avos, you remember the second Mishnah, is Shimon HaTzadik, who is supposed to be of the remnant of the Knesset HaGedola, of this Great Assembly. And what is Shimon HaTzadik's famous lesson? Bingo. The world stands on three things. Torah, Avoda, Gemilus Chasadim. So the Malbim here says, Avoda is Yoshua ben Yehotzadak and Zerubbabel who build the Beis HaMikdash. Gemilus Chasadim is Nehemiah, because he's involved in reinforcing the wall and taking care of the physical needs of the community. And Torah is Ezra. He's the one who establishes Torah for the Jewish people. That's a great comment. I wanted to bring it on the sheet and I ran out of room. And it's really too bad. But Ezra is the framer of public halakhic observance. We're going to find out all sorts of things that Ezra did along the way. And this takes us back now to the source that I said we were going to come back to. Aha! Source number 6. Which identifies Ezra with Malachi. You might be wondering, why are we identifying Ezra with Malachi? I mean, Malachi is Mordechai and Ezra. Well, actually, I jumped the gun. Sorry. I'm going to do it quickly because we're running out of time. But we said that Malachi is Mordechai, and we asked, why was he called Malachi? Because Mordechai is the second to the king. He's the agent of the king. But then the Gemara asked, but wait a minute. I have a text that says that Mordechai and Malachi both prophesied in the second year of King Darius. They can't be the same person, right? They're listed separately in the sentence. Now, for those of us who decided that Artashasta was Darius with Cyrus, that's easy. Nonetheless, to you, the Gemara says, you're right. Okay, reject the idea that Mordechai is Malachi. And then it says, Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha says, Malachi is Ezra. By the way, Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha might have been Rabbi Akiva. So we have multiple... that's not a joke. That's actually not a joke. I can explain that later. After 2:30. But Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha says, Malachi is Ezra. His real name is Malachi. How do you get the association between Ezra and Malachi? Those of you who were here when we learned Malachi will remember, one of Malachi's key messages is a rebuke of the Jewish men who had married non-Jewish women, which is Ezra's theme. Ezra spends a lot of time, as well Nehemiah, on this issue of intermarriage among the Jews. And so the association makes sense between Ezra and Malachi as these leaders who inveigh against the marrying of the foreign women. What Ezra clearly is in all of this is, number one, a leader. Number two, someone who's going to stand for Torah on a very practical level. What he also is, and this will be my last note, and we'll see it when we get into chapter 7, is that he is a pious figure who has zero interest in self-aggrandizement. We're going to see a lot of contrast between the way Ezra conducts himself and the way Nehemiah conducts himself. And what Ezra gets from the king and what Nehemiah gets from the king. Artaxerxes is going to give Ezra all sorts of powers and he's not going to use them. He's going to have the ability to do whatever he wants and he's not going to. He's fundamentally a righteous figure who's interested in leading the Jewish people back to Torah observance. That's his agenda. I don't remember. Oh, that, right. No, he's very geared towards the practical implementation of Torah, and he makes significant moves on those lines. So, God willing, after Pesach. Just one second. After Pesach, we're actually going to launch into chapter 7, so don't forget everything that we said about Ezra, you know, for the last 40 minutes or so. Francis has a question, so I'll take the question and then, yeah.
Could you make a note, please, if possible, and if there's room on the next set of sheets to give us that little bit you said you didn't have room for this time, the three.
The Malvin?
Yeah.
Yeah. Neither, I will include it next time or I'll send it out in an email.
Okay.
One or the other. One or the other. But the business of Yeshua ben Karcha is that Karcha means bald.
Yeah.
That's the term. And at one point, one of the sages says about Rabbi Akiva, all of the sages are, to me, like the skin of garlic, which is to say, thin, transparent, you know, they, except for Chutz Mehakereach Hazeh. Except for this bald one, which you look at and think, that can't be. You can't really get away with saying that about someone like Rabbi Akiva. And the suggestion is made, we find in the Gemara that certain people were named based on coats so that the Romans wouldn't know who was being discussed. So Rabbi Gamliel was the one with the nose. That was what he was called, Balachotem, the one with the nose, which in Roman times may have been a compliment, a Roman nose. But it's suggested by Tosfos that Rabbi Akiva was known as the Kireach, the bald one, as a code name, if you will, and it's suggested that Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha could have been Rabbi Akiva or Rabbi Akiva's son. There's a lot of very interesting discussion in the Tosafot Bava Basra about this because it creates other problems chronologically, but that's an interesting note. If anyone has to go, they can go. I'll take a couple of minutes for the further discussion because we'll be breaking for Pesach.
You want to plug the companion?
Sorry? Plug the companion. Well, the